Hello, everybody. This is Rob Fredette with the podcast HodgePod, and I have another special guest on my podcast. And Joe Strupp has been gracious enough to join me. He is a journalist, a reporter up in New Jersey, and he's written two books. He's written four books, but the last two books he's written are dealing with true crime, and he has been gracious enough to join me on my podcast. And Joe, thank you very much for joining me. I'm looking forward to talking to you about this. And first of all, welcome.
Thank you for having me as well. Good to be here.
You are a reporter up in New Jersey at the Asbury Park Press, and that is in Neptune, yes. New Jersey. Is that correct?
Correct.
So how long have you been in the journalism business?
Actually, I've been a reporter for 35 years. I have been at the press for almost 5 years. Actually, next month will be 5 years. But I've worked at four different newspapers on the East Coast and West Coast. Also worked for one magazine that covered media called Editor and Publisher, and then also Media Matters for America, which covered conservative media. Mm-hmm. But I returned to local news about 5 years ago because I really missed it. That was how I really was raised in news. My first job was at a paper in Elizabeth, New Jersey called the Daily Journal, which is no longer with us. And I'm really basically a news junkie. The books came about from different things I was interested in. And I've also been a freelance writer for New Jersey Monthly and a handful of other outlets. And I also did my own podcast years ago. Mm-hmm. One is called The Retro Room, which is about vintage news and television and broadcasting. And the other is called Joe's Media Corner, which was about different media issues. These both came out, I believe, in 2019. And they're still on Anchor and Spotify if you search them. But I've also been a media commentator. I was on The O'Reilly Factor and MSNBC and CNN and Fox News Watch several times in 2004. Hmm. And so that came from my media reporting years ago. But more recently, I've basically gone back to local news, but also the true crime and just things of interest. And I actually have a revamped website, joestrupp.com, which kind of has all my array of stuff across, 3.5 decades of news coverage. So.
That is a
wide variety, but I still love it, and I'm still consider myself a reporter at heart, more than a writer.
So when you wrote these your two books on true crime, obviously the question would be your journalistic experience would help you get research for these books. Is that correct?
Oh yes, very much. I mean, they were basically you start off as a reporter. They're both true crime. They're both true stories. And I just delved into them. The first one is called A Long Walk Home. That came out 2 years ago. That was focused on the case of Carol Ann Farino. She was a 17-year-old girl in Maplewood, New Jersey, where I used to live, who was only 17 at the time, as I said. And she was walking home from her house in 1966 on a November night, walking home, I should say, to her house from work. She worked in a downtown diner in Maplewood, which is a small town, about half an hour outside of New York City. She never made it home. Her body was found less than an hour later, strangled to death on a side street. And the killer has never been found. And I lived in Maplewood for 20 years, and I kept hearing about this case. It's still the only unsolved murder in the whole town history. And I wanted to look into it. So I just started getting copies of police reports and tracking down people who knew her, and found out that the Maple Police Department very well could have bungled part of the investigation because they looked into people she knew, mm-hmm. including her father, who they really focused attention on wrongly because he had a clear alibi. They didn't really look at it being a possible stranger, which is what the theory right now is. It was probably a stranger because she worked in a diner at night that was actually near the train station in Maplewood. So a lot of people coming and going. And the thought was someone probably picked her up, tried to have their way with her maybe, and strangled her and left her body on the street. And there's still never been a suspect. Although in the book, I go into several potential suspects and one key person that I believe is the most likely. But there's still a lot of pieces of it. And I also came across her sister. She had one sister who was 11 at the time, who's still around and was very helpful in the book. And part of the book is kind of how it affected her. She's been trying to get answers. The police haven't responded. Mm. The Essex County Prosecutor's Office hasn't responded. That's In New Jersey, we don't have district attorneys. They call them county prosecutors. And the county that Maplewood is in, which is also the same county as Newark and a lot of other cities, very busy crime area, has been very unhelpful. So that was the first book, still available. And then the most recent one is called Death on St. Charles Street, which is about a quadruple murder-suicide in my own family. My grandmother's family, my grandmother was one of six children who grew up in South Dakota. And she had two sisters and three brothers. And in 1962, one of her sisters was married to a man named John Bowman, who killed her and two of their children and himself. And the mystery is, why did he do it? He had been in and out of a mental hospital. He had never been violent. He did not leave a suicide note. And it was really unclear what drove him. But the story also goes in how it affected my family, my grandmother, her siblings, my mother, and two of my aunts. And really how this family secret was not talked about for decades. Mm. And then I kind of stumbled upon it at a family reunion, start investigating and interviewing people. And I tracked down people who knew them, who knew the children who were killed, and even the priest who gave them last rites on a Sunday morning. He was called in from, he was doing mass in South Dakota. And basically police called it, hey, we have four dead bodies. You got to come and give them last rites. He kind of handed over the reins of the mass that morning, went on to do it, and he gave some great insight into what happened. So it's partly an investigation into what occurred in this case. Although we know who did it, we really don't know why. And it also gave a good insider's account from this family, you know, how did it affect me, my family, having this in our history and not really ever knowing the answers. And so a lot of people have been reading it, and I really found out some things I didn't know about my family. How they grew up, what it was like in the early days of South Dakota, and how a murder like this or a murder spree like this affects not only the victims, but those who were left to wonder why. So those are kind of two different kinds of true crimes. Both had a connection to me. One was in a town that I lived in at the time, mm-hmm. and also involved a sister who I got to talk to, was a real big part of the book. And then obviously the second one, involving my own family, my mother, my grandmother, and the impact on their lives and their willingness. My aunt said she had not even thought about it for years. They kind of tucked it away. And then when I started digging into it, they started thinking about it themselves. And a lot of information came out that I think they didn't even know. So it was very interesting for me to have those connections in two different pieces, but both true crime with kind of an unusual twist to each.
What was your feel? What were you first thinking about when you heard about the murder suicide in your family? What was your first reaction? I would beg to ask, because that must have been a shocker for you.
Shock, yes, it was. I go into the book about, we were at a family reunion, looking at slides and home movies, and this one woman came up on one of the home movies, and my aunt was telling us, you know, this is this aunt and this aunt. You know, I never knew them, because most of them died before I was 11 years old, but I had heard the names. My grandmother, Peggy, obviously I knew, and her sister, Dorothy, I had heard about, and her brothers. And then this other woman appeared. I said, who is that? And my Aunt Kay said, well, that's your great aunt, Alberta. And I said, oh, I don't remember her. And she said, well, she died before you were born, which is true. These murders occurred before I was born. Mm-hmm. And then my wife actually said to my aunt, how did she die? And everyone was kind of quiet. And my aunt was kind of took a pause, like, oh, should I say anything or not? And she said, well, she was murdered. And then, you know,
wow,
the light bulb went off my reporter head. What? Murdered? I've covered a lot of murders. I've covered a lot of crimes. Never one in my own family or one as heinous as this. And that kind of set the light bulb off. And I tucked it away and started asking questions, but then I didn't really pursue it for a couple of years. And I actually got involved in the case in Maplewood first, mm-hmm. years later. And once I completed that book, which I really enjoyed doing because it was fun to learn about kind of the investigative elements and all, I returned to this case and really started digging into it. One thing that was surprising is how many people in my family were willing to talk about, you know, and even my wife and I talked about, well, you know, do we want to dig up this sad memory. But when I reached out to my aunts and my mother and other relatives, they were very willing to talk, because I think a lot of them wanted to kind of research and try to dig out the truth. And then when I started to track down people who knew them in South Dakota, I was surprised how many people were still around who knew the children who were killed, because they were in their teen years. Mm-hmm. So, you know, teenagers in 1962 still alive today in many cases, and a lot of them were very, very willing to help. So I just went about both of them as a reporter, trying to find the story. And the other thing I enjoyed about writing all my books, and I think a lot of authors might agree, is when you're writing a book, you can kind of take it wherever you want. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You're writing a news story. You can get creative and point out certain things and make sure you include certain things. But when you're writing a book, and I learned a lot of this from reading other true crime books, that you can kind of take an issue and kind of go off on it for a little bit if it's interesting, and come back to the main story and then sort of say, oh, what about this piece of it, and go into, and that was really fun. And I think it helps the reader not just get bogged down, because true crime can be, you know, scary, can be depressing. Mm-hmm. It can be, unnerving. But if you sort of go, like I go into the history of South Dakota in many ways, the Dust Bowl hit South Dakota many years before the rest of the country in the early part of the 20th century. And my grandmother's family was very poor. They grew up in some small areas of South Dakota outside of Rapid City. That's where the murders occurred. And anyone who knows South Dakota, Rapid City is on the western end, right by Mount Rushmore. And then I went out there to visit and do some research. And so I tried to paint a picture of the area at the time and kind of this family, my aunt, great aunt's family that I never knew, what led to this terrible crime and this terrible tragedy. And part of it was mental illness on the part of my great uncle. I don't want to paint him as just this evil villain, which I don't think he was. I think he was a sick person. He was dealing with mental illness. He was dealing with stress, depression, anxiety. And that is something a lot of people deal with, and it drives them to criminal action. Does that make it okay? Of course not. It's not an excuse, but I think it's important for people to understand the impact and why mental health is so important, and to remove that stigma. Mm-hmm. I was also interested to learn how mental illness was handled at the time. And this is 1962. This is, you know, more than 60 years ago. And there was medication at the time. You wouldn't really think, I didn't realize. And there was treatment. He went to the Mayo Clinic. He went to a state hospital in South Dakota. And, you know, it was a little bit more advanced than you might think, but obviously not as much as today. And I also talked to a lot of criminologists and psychiatric experts on crime who said, gave insight into what drives someone to do this and how can you learn. And sometimes you don't know all the answers, but sometimes things aren't as black and white as you would think. That's another thing I've learned as a reporter. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of times we like to, the media as well, likes to present things as good and evil, or black and white, or, you know, this side is right or that side is wrong. Things are rarely that simple. You know, things are complex. The same with the first book, The Murder of Caroline Farino. What occurred there? You know, did the police really go through all the evidence the proper way? And plus, it took place in a small town, which didn't deal with a lot of murders. And a lot of, especially in 1966, there was no DNA. There was no kinds of cell phones and hidden cameras and, you know, being able to track where people are all the time. And that played a role in how the police likely mishandled the case.
Wow, that's incredible, just the way you explained everything. What about when you were writing the book? Did you have to gain the trust of people? Because I've had authors on my podcast, and they've had to get trust of folks, and then that leads to more and more interviews. Is that something you had to do even with your own family? Because I would think maybe they would want to get that information out there, maybe not put some closure, but get it off their chest.
Yes, I think I've been a reporter a long time, and I think one of the things I've learned is how to get people to open up. I've always been lucky in that way. I don't know, I guess because I'm genuinely curious. You know, I think I tell people I'm nosy and curious. I'm a reporter because I'm nosy. I'm not nosy because I'm a reporter. You know, I think most people in our business, you don't get in this business for big money or easy work. You get into it because you got the bug. You know, I'm a nosy, curious person. And when I do a story, I really am genuinely interested in finding out what's going on, especially with people. I'm just as curious interviewing, you know, some custodian who works in a, you know, school backroom mopping floors as I would be interviewing the Shah of Iran or somebody. You know, to me, what drives someone or how they work at their job or at what they do or who they are, what's interesting about someone. I've always been that way. Maybe that's why I'm a reporter. And so when I interview people, I really have a genuine curiosity in learning what they have to say. And I think people can tell that. I think people have a good barometer of when someone's asking them questions, if they're really curious or if they're just sort of going through the motions. And you know, when you talk to someone, if you show you're listening and are interested, they respond. And then obviously when you show them that you're honest about it and you want to try to be fair, especially in today's media landscape, everyone thinks we're, you know, slanting the news or we're biased. Nothing's stranger to me when I write a story and someone who was a subject or involved in the story will email me, "Oh boy, your story was very fair and balanced." And, you know, and I'm like, "Oh, well, isn't it supposed to be?" Maybe not what people think. So that's true. In both cases, when I first interviewed Carol Anfernino's sister, her name is Cynthia. I tracked her down. She still lives in New Jersey. And I thought maybe I would just get a little bit of comment from her to go along with the book. But once we talked, she was actually dealing with some personal issues at the time. Her husband was very sick. And I thought maybe she was just trying to, you know, brush me off. But then a couple months later, he unfortunately passed away. Couple months later, she reached back to me and said, you know, "Are you still interested in doing that book?" And I said, "Yeah, I've been working on it, you know, talking to other people." And she said, "Well, you know, I'm glad to help." And she really did. And we're still in touch to this day. And I think she realized I really wanted to find out the truth. And the same with my family members. Most of them, I was surprised too, because it's a sad kind of, you know, tough story. You want people to know about your murderous relative. And most of them were very open about it. And a lot of the friends of the family, especially the children who were killed, they were very open too. I think they wanted people to know what happened and what, you know, what they were like. I always say when I've been a reporter, I've often had to interview family members of deceased people. You know, someone's killed, whether it's a car accident or a shooting or something, especially children. You have to go and talk to the family. And people always think, "Oh, how can you go up to a relative of someone who was just killed and ask them how?" Well, first of all, people think wrongly that a reporter will say, "How do you feel?" Which is not what I've ever said. I would always go up to a family member or a relative or parent and just say, "Look, you know, I'm calling from whatever news outlet I worked at. I understand this is a tough time, but we're just doing a story on it. And like to ask you a few questions." And sometimes they say no and you leave them alone. But sometimes they say, "Okay," kind of hesitant. And I wouldn't say, "How do you feel?" I would say, "Tell me about the person." That's a simple, basic. Most of the time they want to talk about it. They want to tell the world who this person was. You know, if it's a child or a relative, you know, they don't want it to just be a name and a police story or a statistic. They want everyone to know that, you know, their son or wife or somebody was a wonderful person and would do such and such or had done this or had always helped people or whatever it is. And you also gain a little trust that way because they know you're not just out to write something horrible, or they I think sense that you really want to learn about it. And then they open up and then you can ask them more things. And I think that relationship really opens and is genuine. And I also teach journalism. I teach two classes. And that's one of the things I teach my students is, you know, ask people genuine, curious questions. And if you ask them about themselves or about the person, they'll tend to open up and trust you. And that's what it's all about. You know, if you're talking to someone for a story or a book, they want to know that you're trustworthy, that they tell you something, it's going to be both accurate and fair and also respectful. And I think in these both of these cases, I hopefully came up with that result.
I think the key thing you said, listen, respectful, genuine, and I think people will know when they're getting BS from somebody. And you obviously were able to connect and with your family members and also Carol Ann Farino's younger sister. So I did go to, when I was in college, I did study journalism and radio and TV. So I know about getting the facts and, you know, sticking with the story. So I know exactly what you're talking about with that. And sure. It's very important, you know, to get the facts and then line them up, you know, if you're doing a news story. So a long time ago, I didn't end up doing that, but I still remember it to this day. So very interesting. So let's look.
Yeah, at- I think most reporters, I'm sorry, I just want to say,
yeah,
I think most reporters are trying to get the story. Most of us are just trying to get the truth and tell it in the factual way. I know our business has taken a beating over the years, and in many ways it deserves it. But I still think the crux of what we do is just being nosy and curious people and trying to find a story and tell it all balanced and fairly and get the word out. And sometimes that doesn't always work, but I think the intention is generally there. Although there's still people in our biz who don't, and I understand people are critical of that, and they should be. But I think it's still just an effort to get a story out in a way that's interesting, but factual, and that gets people to notice whatever it is you're trying to write about.
Absolutely. So looking at the Carol Ann Farino case, one question I have is, you worked in a diner, so I grew up in a small town in Massachusetts, so everybody knows everybody. Everybody is aware of what's going on. She worked in a diner. Did anybody see anything, like maybe somebody that was trying to come on to her or giving her trouble in the diner that may have maybe led to her murder? Because I find that incredible that she was just walking home from work and she gets murdered. I mean, that's just horrible.
Yeah, it's some of the problems we've had with the police in Maplewood and the Essex County Prosecutor's Office is they will not let us look through the files. When I initially did, and this is in the book, I initially did reporting. I got police reports and a lot of information from people who knew her and who remembered their police efforts. The police did not really go down that road, which was one of the problems that I point to in the book. They didn't really go looking for the stranger or the person who might have seen her. They focused on her friends and relatives and really pushed on the father too much. And the father was home when the murders occurred, or when the murder occurred, and he had worked as a delivery man for the Star-Ledger, the newspaper, big newspaper in New Jersey. And so he would work early morning hours. And so by 4 o'clock in the afternoon, he was home in bed, taking a nap. And she was last seen around 7:30, and she was found around 8:30. On a Thursday night. And the way that she was found was that her father was home sleeping and the mother was worried that she hadn't come home from work. She had left work about 7:30. It gets to be a little after 8. Her home was about a half mile walk from where she worked. So maybe, you know, 20 minutes at the most. So she's not home yet. The mother got nervous. She actually asked her sister to wake the father up to go look for her. And the father went looking for her. And he actually ended up at the police station because he was getting nervous. And when he got to the police station, the police told him they had found her body, I guess only a couple, 10, 15 minutes earlier. And but they never focused on the fact that it could have been a stranger or that it could have been someone from the diner or maybe downtown. She was seen, according to some of the information I found, she was seen leaving the downtown area by one witness who was apparently working on his car because his car wouldn't start. And also they talked to the owner of the restaurant, the diner, who said, you know, yeah, she left at a certain time. I don't think he noticed anyone sneaky or suspicious, but that's as far as it went. And the sister has also tried to get a look at the files, and the police were going to let me look at the files. They claim there's an inch thick file on her. And I actually had an appointment to go see it. And then just a few days before, the police chief, who is no longer with us, he actually died of a terrible surprise death a couple of years ago. He reached out and said, look, the prosecutor's office won't let us give you the files. In New Jersey, the prosecutor's offices have jurisdiction over serious felony crimes. So whenever some major crime happens, they take it over. Now, back in 1966, I don't believe that was the case. So the Maplewood police were handling the case. But today, if you want to get access to files on a case, and it's still considered an open case, even though they haven't really done anything in 50 years, the prosecutor's office has jurisdiction. And so they basically stepped in and said, no access. And I filed public information requests. New Jersey actually has a very good open public records law. And they sent me a lengthy letter explaining why they didn't have to release it and claiming that it was still an open case, even though nothing's been done on it for 50 years. And her sister did the same thing. They denied it to her. We're actually still consulting with a lawyer to try some other ways of getting access. But all the information we can glean is they did not look at potential strangers, or that what you brought up, the fact that it could have been someone from the diner or someone who saw her downtown, and that's the likely killer. It's not likely someone she knew, or her father, or someone in her family. And they just basically, from all accounts, discounted that it could have been a stranger, and that really botched the investigation early. And as you know, the first days, first hours of this kind of investigation are critical. Mm-hmm. And if you blow that chance, the chances of nabbing someone, especially if it is a stranger from out of town, you're really left on the hook because there's really no evidence left.
Did you get a sense of how long the walk home from the diner was? Because that would be, if she was rushing, or that would be one question I would have. How long was her walk home from work?
It was about a half mile. So you're talking maybe 20 minutes.
Yeah.
But it was a Thursday night in November, November 3rd, 1966. And by all accounts, I looked at the weather reports. It was very chilly, 20 or 30 degrees. And so there was theory that if someone stopped to offer her a ride in a cold weather, she might have taken it. Now, her family and her sister claimed she would not get into a car with a stranger. But if you're walking home on a cold night, after working whatever hours. The other theory we had is many people went in and out of this diner at night. There were cab drivers who were stationed nearby. There was a movie theater. There was a train station across the street. A lot of in and out, a lot of transients would come in and out of that downtown area. A lot different than today. It's a little more upscale today. But the thought was there might've been some regulars in the diner who got to know her, and maybe she would recognize a familiar face, right? There is deviant behavior, you know what I mean? There are people who go in, pretty waitress.
Man.
Young woman in a waitress uniform is friendly to you, right, when they serve you. Who's hanging around at a diner at, you know, night by themselves? You know, maybe not the most upstanding men in the world. And so perhaps this was someone who was a regular or semi-regular, who she got to know, who was nice, maybe somewhat attractive. She's walking home, cold, tired. Guy pulls up, hey, oh, hey, John or Fred, whoever, you know, how you doing? Well, you need a ride? No, I'm okay. Come on, you got to be cold. And here's a friendly face. He tipped well, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, I'll get in. That's all it takes. You know, there was no real evidence when they found her. She was strangled with her stocking. Her girdle and underwear were pulled down, according to the police reports. So the thought is someone tried to have their way with him, tried to have their way with her, and either got interrupted or got scared, or maybe she hit him or something, and his reaction was not to run off, but get mad, had her stockings in hand. Jeez. There you go. The police also apparently have never done any DNA testing on her clothes. Her sister's trying to get the clothes back. All she ever got back was her coat, her stockings and undergarments and waitress outfit never returned to the family. And the police
go ahead, I'm sorry.
Are offering no help in bringing it up.
I was going to ask that. You said you asked for the information request. I was asking if it was like freedom of information you could ask for to get it. And that's just, this seems puzzling that they wouldn't reveal or give that information even to her sister.
Correct. And again, we're still going on some legal avenues that might work for her as her sister, as next of kin. But basically, as you know, there's the Freedom of Information Act, which is the federal law. But New Jersey actually has a very, very good version called the Open Public Records Act, or OPRA. And we filed many of those. And the claim by the police department was willing to help. But then the prosecutor's office came in and denied it. And their claim is it's still an open case. And now we're looking to possibly sue on that basis. But that takes money and invite too. We reached out to some attorneys who are looking through it. But yes, it's a very kind of weak argument. Well, it's still an open case. Well, you haven't done anything. How open can it be? And this is a relative. So we've definitely not closed down any avenues. And last year, we raised money for a park bench in Maplewood in her honor that lots of people donated money for. And then the Maplewood Township Committee, which is basically their city council, passed a resolution a year ago urging the prosecutor's office to reopen the case. Now, of course, that has no real power, but it does highlight the issue, and we're still trying to get attention for it to get the case reopened.
Well, that is that. Hopefully, you can get the evidence from the case, and hopefully, maybe help solve this and give her kudos to her sister for fighting the good fight to get that information. She's had to live that throughout her whole life, and yes. She was younger than Carol Ann. Is that correct?
Yes, she was only 11 at the time. And as we say in the book, she was actually in her living room watching TV with her mother and fell asleep on the couch. And then when the police came, she basically was woken up by a police officer later that night. A police officer basically woke her up and told her that her sister had been killed. Now, how's that for a
jeez
harsh wake up call? Yeah. Imagine when you're 11 years old. And according to her, they were like best friends. She was talking about how Carol would tell her secrets about her, you know, life and boys she went out with. And by all accounts, she was an amazing girl. You know, everyone I talked to who knew her friends and her old boyfriend. She was a beautiful young woman, very friendly, very kind, worked hard to make money for, you know, spending money. The parents were very strict and. But everyone I talked to who knew her said she was just a nice person. She would also be very friendly to anyone, which could mean also, you know, a man or boy with ulterior motives. You know, maybe someone would come up to her and she'd be friendly to them, just nice. And maybe they would take that the wrong way and make a move. Mm. And it backfired and they got angry. That's all it takes, right? Especially a waitress. You know, they make money by being nice. So a customer, not the nicest of customers, get some nice treatment from this pretty young woman.
Right.
Maybe he thinks, oh, I'm going to make a move, and backfires and he blows up at her. That's it.
This case is 58 years old, 1966.
1966.
Wow.
Your addition's better than mine.
Now it's okay. Yeah. I don't know about tomorrow, but yes. Let's talk about your second book. Is that upcoming, Death on St. Charles Street?
That was actually published last month.
Okay.
In March. And it's actually gotten a lot of great attention in Rapid City in the South Dakota area. And if you go to my website, joestrup.com, you can get links to all the coverage. And some in the in other areas as well. Some of the other true crimes like you, I appreciate. And that just came out, and that's gotten a lot of good reaction. And also for my family members, but also people who you know, just hear from multiple in your family. What? You know, how many people know someone in their family who was murdered, let alone four of them? And I certainly didn't. I've been, you know, a reporter a long time. Mm. I've been lucky. My family has not had that kind of criminal victim impact. And it really also opened up to me what it was like for victims, you know, to have family members that I know have to live through this. And there really is no other viewpoint of this kind of crime than the victim or the relatives. And I've covered many crimes over the years, many murders, but never one that touched this close. So for me, it was a really interesting journey to learn about this, to learn how it happened, to learn how it affects people, and how it's still unsolved in a way that we know who did it, but we don't necessarily know why, and maybe never will. But it definitely lays out, and there's also criminal experts in this book, in both books. Near the end, I talked to a lot of criminal experts, psychiatric experts, criminologists, and painting pictures of what brings this about. Why would this man kill his whole family and himself, you know, when he wasn't violent, when he had gotten medical treatment? And I also got access to his medical records from the state hospital in South Dakota, which I was very surprised. I just filed a request there.
Mm-hmm.
They sent them all to me. And there's a lot of telling detail in there that really helped flesh out the story and what he was going through. And also a lot of friends who knew the family. He was mentally ill. He had definite mental problems. But my great aunt was alcoholic by many people's accounts. So you talk about a tough marriage. One person's an alcoholic. One person's got depression and mental illness problems. And they have three sons they're trying to take care of. And one of the sons also became quite the drinker at the time. But also learned a lot about my grandmother's family when she was growing up, how poor they were and what life in South Dakota was like. But also some interesting history of that area. You know, what it was like at the time for police to respond to such a heinous crime. You know, and who was the medical examiner at the time? And who handled these kind of cases, right? Really an interesting pieces of the story. And I learned a lot about my family as well. And I think a lot of my relatives did, who knew just very little about the case because it wasn't talked about. You know, it was a family secret. And why not? I mean, why are you going to go around talking about this horrible crime that no one really understood? But here's a way to kind of get to the understanding. And I think one of the keys was the mental health records and state hospital records, and also recollections from everyone from friends of the boys who were killed to the priest on the scene to even the people from the funeral home who had to remove the bodies. Really interesting to learn all this, you know, 60 plus years later. And pretty apropos. There's also some side stories and even a cameo by Ernest Hemingway.
Ernest Hemingway.
I won't give away more than that.
But. All right, you got it. Let me ask you this. I know you had, when you found out, did you find yourself having a focus to find out what happened with your family, the situation, to go on it, or the drive to try to find out? And what was the reaction of the book, of your surviving family members on this book? Has it helped them as well?
I think it has. Several of them have already read it and told me they liked it. And they pointed out a few little critiques. I kind of took the approach, you know, one of my favorite true crime books, probably the, you know, grandfather of them all, In Cold Blood, Truman Capote's great expose of the murders in the Kansas town. Part of that is fictional, based on nonfiction. Most of this is accurate, fact-based, but there are some recreated scenes that I think are valid based on information I learned from people, based on interviews, based on research, based on his state hospital records that had a lot of very detailed conversations between his doctors and himself, where he really opened up about his marriage, about his thoughts, about his feelings of his life and his marriage and his children. And so I reconstruct a lot of things out of that. But that was really kind of the focus I started with, getting the facts, looking for police reports, looking for hospital records, and just starting to interview people. And as you know, as most reporters know, you start interviewing people, you find one or two sources, they will lead to other sources. One of the best research tools I used were the obituaries. Back in the day, when news stories were done, not just stories about this heinous crime, but often when a funeral was held, there would be extended stories in the paper about the funeral, not just an obituary about the person, but after the funeral, listing pallbearers and the priest or minister. So I got a hold of those old clippings.
Wow.
From the Rapid City Journal, which is the paper that I still have to give them great credit. I got copies of those stories. They listed the pallbearers, listed the priest who did the work, listed. So I just started tracking them down, and many of them were still alive and willing to talk. And also, there were two visitors to the family who were just staying overnight and living, staying in the basement, friends of the Bowmans. The Bowmans were Alberta and John, the two parents, and Jack, Bruce, and Maurice, the three sons. Now, Jack, the oldest, was not home. He was back at college. But the two sons were there. And they had two family friends who happened to be staying overnight. It was a Saturday night into Sunday. And I had tracked them down as well. And they gave me a lot of first-person account of finding the bodies. And how often do you get that for this kind of story, especially 60 years later? Mm. So one story led to another, and then they remembered people, and the pallbearers remembered people who knew people. And then I did research. They all went to a Catholic high school in Rapid City. I found the yearbook for that and learned about the kids. Some of them played sports. Some of them were in different Catholic youth groups. Really helped paint a picture of what occurred. And then the news coverage was very extensive. And I used a lot of that to paint a picture of what occurred. The other thing I tracked down, there were very few police reports because this occurred in 1962. In 1972, there was a huge flood in the Rapid City area that wiped out, police told me, most of the police records. Now, this is 1972. Not a lot of computer files, you know. Nope. Things aren't on digital.
Nope.
And things are wiped out. They're gone. But even without that, I was lucky to track down, I think, all the information I needed, and maybe even more so because I did not have the police report to fall back on. I had to find other sources, which I think made it even more interesting. And then I talked to many relatives who had stories about the family. My last surviving great aunt, Dolores Conley, who just died last year at 104, I believe. She had lived next door to the family with her husband, who was my grandmother's brother. And she gave me great insight into what it was like living with them, living near them, and also living in the family at the time. So I was very fortunate to come across a lot of sourcing material, but most of it was just starting out with basic research like any other crime. You know, you track down law enforcement, you find people involved, people who knew them, and one source generally leads to another, the same with the Farino book. I went to her yearbook that year and came across, and her sister remembered some names of her friends. You go online, search for them. Another person says, oh, talk to this person, talk to that person. And pieces fall into place. It's really fascinating and interesting how that happens. And then you go down different roads. And I have a lot of criminologists, a lot of experts, and sort of say, look, here's the evidence. Here's the police reports. Mm-hmm. I had a criminologist review John Bowman's mental health records, and they could glean from that, oh, you know, he might have been driven by this or that. And it really helps paint an interesting picture, both of the crime and of the people involved.
Incredible. And it's just like putting a puzzle together. You would find out some information, and then that would lead to more information, and then you were able to complete the book. It's quite fascinating what you just explained. One thing that I noticed, like with crime stories and things, sometimes the victims are forgotten. That's one thing I wish that would happen. We would hear more about the victims rather than the person who did the crime. I'm just talking in general. We don't hear from the victims as much or given time as much as like the crime. And sometimes that bothers me because the victims are the ones that have to live with it forever.
Yes. And I think in both these cases, I was lucky enough. Well, in the Carroll case, we don't even know the criminal. So we really focus a lot on the victim and the fact that it's still unsolved. But a lot of people told me great background on Carol, who she was, how she acted. And then with my great aunt and uncle, lots of information about the two of them, but also the children, because I got to know a lot of people who knew them, but also just learn how they spent their time. You know, the youngest son was very active in sports and was a pretty good student. And but the second oldest one, who was his own, it was a drinker himself. He had dropped out of high school at a young age, and he and the mother drank together a lot. So, you know, you talk about addiction, alcoholism or drug addiction. I mean, it's, you know, 2024, things haven't changed a lot. You know, a lot of people still have, today it's fentanyl or heroin or something else. It's still alcohol. I'm sure you know people who've had alcohol problems. I do. And even back then, it's a piece of every family. Now, does that contribute to the murder? Maybe in one way, it helped dysfunction in the family. And whatever way that his wife or his children had problems, maybe John couldn't handle it. And he turned to his own stresses and depressions and just blew up someday. But yeah, the victims are necessary. And people who went to the funeral, they were all at one funeral. It was four caskets in a row, which is something a lot of the family still remembers. You know, there was talk of having different funerals, and I think the surviving son just wanted to get it over with. It was so true. And I learned a lot about him, how he handled it. He had to basically, one day he's going back to college at University of Minnesota. The next day he's planning four funeral for four people. His family's wiped out. But he had to go on, and he went on for a while. He had a pretty good career. He was a pilot for a while, but then a lot of story about what happened to him. He had troubles in the end of his life, and he ended up having a tough downfall. And also the two men who were, or the two friends who were in the basement who found the bodies, had their own difficulties going on after such a horrible discovery of their friends being killed. So a lot of pieces of it, I think, that maybe people don't expect or understand come out of it when you hear about these crimes. And I really wanted to try to present them as people and real stories, not just, you know, statistics or a headline of another murder or another death, that there are people behind these stories. And a lot of it is out of my own curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I do that with any story, especially any crime story. Why does this happen? Can it be prevented? And is the full story being told? A lot of times it isn't.
One other question I have is, I know you've been a reporter for many years. What are some high-profile stories that you've written over the years that you could share with me, over the years that you could share with my audience? Because I find your career fascinating for the longevity and writing books and where you've been. What are some high-profile things you've written?
Oh, God. It's I've been able to cover a lot of areas. My first jobs, I worked at four newspapers. My first job was, said, it was at the Daily Journal in Elizabeth, New Jersey. Then I moved to California. I worked at two newspapers in Northern California. One is the Argus in Fremont, California, which is south of San Francisco. Another one was in San Francisco, the Independent, which was a free newspaper that covered the city. Then I moved to Riverside, California, which is about an hour outside of L.A., and I covered crime and courts. That was kind of my first taste mm-hmm. of really covering crime. And then I started freelancing for a magazine called Editor and Publisher, which covered the newspaper business. And I started freelancing and getting really interested in journalistic issues. And then I was hired by them. They're based in New York. And I worked there for 11 years, from 1999 to 2010. And then they were sold and they cut back. And I went from there to Media Matters for America, which is a website, nonprofit that covers the conservative media. And I covered a lot of media issues for them, from political reporting to coverage of crime to all kinds of areas. I went to several conventions and also the Conservative Political Action Committee, the Conservative Political Action Convention Conference. CPAC,
yep,
which takes place every year in Washington. That was really interesting. Covered a lot of conservative media and a lot of political issues. And then I got laid off from there. They had some big cutbacks. And then I was freelancing for a while, and I did my own website in Maplewood on local issues. And then I came to the Asbury Park Press 5 years ago. So it's been all variety of news. One of the biggest stories I covered was an editor and publisher. It's a business story about the Detroit News World. Back in, I think it was 2005, Detroit has two newspapers, the Detroit Free Press and the Detroit News. And back then, if you can follow me, the Detroit Free Press was owned by Knight Ridder. And the Detroit News was owned by Gannett. And there was a deal brewing where Knight Ridder would sell the Detroit Free Press to Gannett, and Gannett would sell the Detroit News to a third company, Media News. And I got a tip from someone in Denver who worked for the Denver Post, which was the Media News' biggest paper. And he said, this big deal is going down. This is basically the two big newspapers in Detroit are switching owners.
Oh.
Now, in the vast scheme of things, that might not be big, but in the newspaper business, it was huge. So I got this tip. No one would talk. The person even gave me information of what was going to occur, who was going to buy what, and also who the new editor of the Detroit News was going to be. It was going to be the editor of the Des Moines Register, which was also owned by Gannett. And I knew him. So I called his house in Des Moines, and I asked for him. And his wife said, oh, he's not home. He's out of town. And I said, oh, where is he? She said, Detroit. Bingo. Then I said, oh, yeah, we understand he's going to be the new editor of the Detroit Free Press. What do you think of moving to Detroit? And, of course, she says, oh, I'm excited. It's going to be bingo. So once I knew the truth, then I could go back to the companies, get sources to confirm. We broke the story. And a couple hours after we broke it, the Associated Press followed up. And then all the Detroit broadcast media started calling me to find out, how did I know this? It was in their backyard, and they didn't even know. So that was kind of a big story.
That's a big scoop.
Also, when I was there, yeah, it was a fun business scoop. But also at the editor and publisher, every year we would cover the Pulitzer Prizes, you know, the annual journalism awards given out by the Columbia Journalism, Graduate School of Journalism, and I would go cover those every year. And at one point, there was a group that would get the list of the finalists. See, the way the Pulitzer Prizes work, there are 14 categories, and there are committees that meet on each category. And they come up with three finalists. And they forward those finalists to the Pulitzer board. And the Pulitzer board decides who wins. Now, they never release the finalists until they release the winners.
Mm.
Because the way the Pulitzers work is the Pulitzer board gets the finalists for each category. They can move them around. You know, they can get finalists for breaking news. And they can say, well, maybe this story should go in explanatory news. So they can move them around. Or they can decide, no, this isn't a finalist, and move it. So they don't want to release the finalists because in the end, they might not be finalists. Most of the time, they are. It's not like the Oscars, you know?
Yeah.
They always announce the Oscar nominees.
Right.
Pulitzer is very different. So there was a group of committee members who would get a list of these finalists and circulate this list. And someone one year sent it to me. And we published it. And got a lot of flack. Oh, my God, how can you leak the finalist list? And then it turned out it was accurate. When the winners came out, they were generally on target. Maybe one or two were wrong. But the vast majority of it, I mean, 14 categories, three finalists each, about 95% were accurate. So for several years, I would release this list. And then after a while, the Pulitzer board cracked down. And some people in the business still refer to it as the Joe Strupp rule.
That's a great story.
And if you search my name in Pulitzer finalists, you'll see some stories like that.
I will.
Some other, I'm trying to think of other big stories. You know, there's so many that, you know, I don't really like to brag.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's stories that I'm lucky enough to break or that were interesting. A couple were in, when I covered crime courts in Southern California, there was a couple of cases. One was the case of Tristan Jensen, who was a 14-year-old in Redlands, California. And he was stabbed to death by a friend, you know, one of friends four. And the friend chopped up his body and threw it in the sewer in front of his house. And this child, you know, he was basically considered missing for weeks. And then one day there was a bad rainstorm. Now, in San Bernardino County, California, there's not a lot of rain. It's basically desert.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a big rainstorm. The sewer in front of his house overflowed. And Public Works Department came to investigate, and they found all these bones of this dead body clogging up the sewer. And that launched an investigation. They found the friend who killed him and arrested him, and he went on trial. And then it turned out that his parents were eventually arrested.
Jeez.
Because they had stockpiled all kinds of weapons in the house, explosives, illegal guns. And the father was a banker, and the mother was a PTA member, very upstanding family, but they had all this kind of secret violence, and the son ended up going to trial and was convicted.
Wow.
And I was able to get the only interview with the parents when they were in jail, because I went through their lawyer, and he said, look, I can't let them be interviewed. I said, well, what if I gave you questions for them and you gave me the answers? And he said, okay. So we got the only, quote, jailhouse interview with them.
Wow.
There was another case, I'll quickly say, a man who had set his girlfriend on fire in the parking lot of a Chuck E. Cheese. He had had two children with her, and she had custody, and she would only meet him in the parking lot because she was afraid of him. And when they met, they had a fight. He went to his trunk of his car, took out cans of gasoline, poured it on her, set her on fire. She died a few days later, and I covered his trial where he basically pleaded for his life on the witness stand, but he was eventually convicted and sentenced to death.
Wow.
So a lot of weird crime.
Yeah, unbelievable. I really appreciate you, Joe Strupp, coming on my podcast here tonight to talk about your two true crime books, and especially the one involving your family. The first book was Long Way Home, The Unsolved Murder of 17-year-old Carol Ann Farino of New Jersey, and the second book, right. Death on St. Charles Street. Joe Strupp, I really appreciate you coming on my podcast. This was very informative.
No, thank you for the